our development director job at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez, Hani Masood. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website, democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 4:59. Stay tuned for the KBOO Tuesday Evening News. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Orford Sustainable Seafood, Oregon's community-supported fishery, delivering monthly shares of line-caught seafood direct from the small fishing town of Port Orford to seafood-loving communities throughout Portland and the Willamette Valley. Details at posustainableseafood.com and at 541-671-0704.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight at participating Portland area restaurants. Nosh for Nonviolence is a collaborative fundraiser for two local domestic violence intervention agencies, the Portland Women's Crisis Line and West Women and Children's Shelter. Again, that's Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight. You can find the list of participating Portland area restaurants at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Start your Saturday morning with a little swingin' country. The KBOO Swingin' Country program will be broadcasting live from the Tin Shed Garden Cafe on Saturday, October 24th from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. I know you've been hankering to put a face to those velvety tones, so here's your chance. You are welcome to come early, pull up a chair, and enjoy some coffee, food, and an earful of swingin' country. The Tin Shed Garden Cafe is located at 1438 Northeast Alberta Street in the City of Roses. Again, that's Swingin' Country live from the Tin Shed, Saturday, October 24th, here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's Appleby Aviation illegal spraying of pesticides has led to a fine and 30-day injunction halting the spraying.
Researchers found methane plumes off the northwest coast have exhaled from warming waters, destabilizing coastal ecology.
Canada has elected a Liberal official after 10 years of Stephen Harper. Good evening, this is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 20th, 2015. I'm Jared Dantzler.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. An Oregon aviation company has agreed to stop spraying pesticides for the next month while it turns over application records to farm regulators. The Oregon Department of Agriculture sought an injunction against Appleby Aviation of Banks, Oregon, because the company allegedly continued to spray pesticides despite a suspension of its applicator's license on September 25th. Appleby Aviation also faces a $40,000 fine and a year-long suspension of its license. Rob Ireland, the company's attorney, told reporters that he could not speak about the allegations. But he said that Appleby Aviation agreed to an injunction yesterday to not spray pesticides for 30 days. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Daryl Ivey, a former employee of Appleby Aviation, who has suffered numerous health problems when he was sprayed with herbicides on the job.
Could you just give us an update on what's the latest with what's happening with Appleby Aviation?
That's a good one. Things are moving so fast, I'm not quite sure where they are. I do know that they're talking about it after defying their order not to fly. They flew anyways, and that's really grabbed the attention of quite a few folks and also brought forth what kind of punishment to give someone that defies your authority that you license. So I don't know. That's something that's developing, I think, daily as we go. I do know right now that they're not allowed to fly. I've had, for 6 months, my life's been hell because I feel like I've had to go behind these state agencies and ask them why they haven't done their jobs or if they are going to do their jobs or what they're going to do. I've been left in the dark. And so to say things happening right now is very, very, I feel like crying. But at the same time, I do know that there's been a lot of coddling and a lot of talking that I'm sure that the public's not aware of, trying to get Mike Appleby up to speed, Appleby Aviation up to speed so that they can fly. Not many companies do the kind of work that the Appleby Aviation does. So when they get taken out of the ball game, it really affects a lot of people that do spraying.
What about your situation? Maybe we could get an update on the problems that you have faced as someone who suffered the effects of being sprayed by these herbicides.
No one ever wants to be put in my shoes. The best thing I can say is don't ever get sprayed. If it ends with side, run. Cyanide, pesticide, herbicide, I don't care. If it is a side, just get out of there because it's changed my whole world. My health is not the same. I was supposed to actually have sinus operation at the end of this week, and it was canceled because they want to get a second opinion. But right now, they're not paying for my medication. So my infection in my sinus is actually getting worse. And the operation to get it fixed was canceled because they want to go get a second opinion. You have three doctors, two hospitals, two scientists, and nine labels, federal labels, stating that these chemicals affect your respiratory system. So it's very disheartening, and it really makes things difficult on me because I'd like this to go away. And the sooner I can get an operation and the sooner I can get everybody to collaborate and move forward, it'd be a blessing.
Now, Daryl, have you filed a lawsuit against Appleby Aviation for the suffering that you have undergone because of their actions?
I would love to. Here's the kicker, though. Not many attorneys want to take on such a high-profile case, number one. And number two, once you start on a workers' comp claim, you are sort of stuck inside the realm of workers' comp law. And so as it stands right now, I am talking to other attorneys, trying to see how to go about making Seneca liable, number one, and Appleby, trying to sue Appleby outside the realm of workers' comp, because it really limits what type of lawsuit and which direction you can go when you're stuck with inside that umbrella of workers' comp laws. It protects the employer more than it does the employee that got injured. In this case right here, you have an employer that thumbs his nose at authority. In fact, not just authority, but the authority that gives him his license. That's like, to me, I liken it as a cop pulling a Ferrari over, and the guy in the Ferrari looks at the ticket for $60, crumbles it up, throws it in the officer's face, and then peels out, because he's making so much money. But you can't do that. The officer has the ability to revoke your license, and that's where I think the state agencies are now. They're realizing that they're going to have to do something quite a bit more heavy-handed than just fine these companies that thumb their nose at their authority.
Well, it almost seems that Appleby Aviation considers itself above the law.
Yeah, I've been waiting for David Hasselhoff, Knight Rider, to pull in here and, deal with these people that assume they're above with the law, because that is exactly what it seems like, not just to me, not to other employees that have stepped forward, but obviously to every person that's called their company and asked questions about the situation. He doesn't answer. He doesn't put out any public statements. And then he goes and flies his helicopter when he's not supposed to. And so it's definitely an eye-opener. I think the cat's out of the bag. I think there's going to be more folks coming forward. Kevin Vanderlee is another employee with the company that was injured due to faulty equipment. And basically a very similar story to myself. He was there for 2 years, though. I was there only for 17 days. And I have a feeling that there's quite a few more folks that are going to come forward now that Mike Appleby's in the spotlight with other issues, whether it was they're injured by the chemicals or faulty equipment or et cetera. But I think that's the next turn in this case is the feds coming down with their fines and more people coming out of the woodwork with their own stories that are probably going to be similar to mine.
And again, we're speaking about Appleby Aviation, safety concerns at the company that have led to a revocation of the license for a year. The company, even after the license was revoked, went ahead and did helicopter runs throughout Western Oregon and has now, just yesterday, October 19th, agreed to an injunction not to spray pesticides for 30 days. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Earlier today, a coalition of environmental groups delivered 31,000 public comments to the office of Senator Ron Wyden in support of the Crater Lake Wilderness Area. Environment Oregon, Oregon Wild, and Umpqua Watershed stood together with businesses, outdoor enthusiasts, and advocates of wild places to deliver the public comments, as well as more than 200 business and organization endorsements. All of the comments voiced support of permanently protecting Crater Lake and the surrounding forests, mountains, and streams by creating a 500,000-acre, 75-mile wilderness corridor around Crater Lake National Park. The threats to Crater Lake include logging proposals, such as the Forest Service Bybee Logging Project, which includes clear-cutting along the western boundary of the park, and a proposed helicopter tour of the park. KBOO's Chris Andre was at today's event and brings us the voices of the activists.
Crater Lake is one of the most incredible places in Oregon, but unfortunately, year after year, Crater Lake and the forests around it and the local ecosystem are threatened by proposals for clear cutting, mining, and even a proposed helicopter tour. What we have today is 31,000 people speaking up saying enough is enough. If there's any place in Oregon that deserves the best possible protection we can give it, it's Crater Lake and the surrounding forests, mountains, and streams. The other important piece of this is making sure that we're showing that a protected Crater Lake is good for the local economy here in Oregon.
A lot of national parks have wilderness protection on top across the West. When you think of Yosemite, Joshua Tree, Denali, Zion, all of these national parks have wilderness protection on top, and Crater Lake is one of the few that doesn't. And what that means is that there is little in the way of Disneyfying the park, if you will. So that's why we've seen these proposals of gondola tours, airport landing strips in the pumice desert, tunnels emerging into yacht harbors. All of these things are a reason why, or as a result of not having wilderness designation on top of the national park. Outside the park boundaries, these areas are just as important, but even more threatened, where we're seeing logging proposals right up to the park boundary. So we're looking at both the national park and the areas outside, totaling about 500,000 acres. And we're hearing some of the rhetoric coming out of D.C. right now and how we treat our public lands. I think that's all the more reason to protect what we have now, the best of what's left in Oregon.
Those were activists in Portland delivering tens of thousands of comments today to Senator Ron Wyden to call for a wilderness designation for Crater Lake National Park.
A report released this week by the American Geophysical Union, AGU, suggests that bubble plumes off the Oregon and Washington coasts may be releasing frozen methane. At depths of 500 meters, a third of a mile, below the surface where there is little marine life, frozen pockets of methane ice transition from a dormant solid into powerful greenhouse gas. Plumes have normally been observed as natural releases from sediments at various depths, but the disproportionately large number of plumes arising specifically from the 500-meter depth is thought to be caused by a warming trend in the ocean currents. As methane is released, some of it enters the atmosphere, but much of it is converted to carbon dioxide, creating more acidic conditions along the coast and in coastal waterways. The higher levels of carbon dioxide, along with warmer pockets of water along the coasts, may already be impacting marine life by lowering the oxygen concentration. Another potential consequence is the destabilization of the seafloor, where frozen methane acts as the glue that holds the steep sediment slopes in place. Not only could large landslides displace significant volumes of water, or even set off tsunamis, slope collapse events also risk uncovering and exposing more frozen methane to the warming ocean in a kind of amplifying feedback.
The Police Bureau held a community forum last night in southwest Portland to discuss equipping the police with body cameras. Dan Handelman, a member of Portland Cop Watch, was one of the attendees. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Handelman to learn more.
Dan, what happened at last night's meeting?
Well, the community wasn't very well represented. There were less than a dozen people, I think, who were there, and even fewer who made comments. There were more members of the Police Bureau and the city and the media there than I think there were the general public, which is kind of disturbing. I think that body cameras, no matter how you feel about them, are a very important tool that the police are going to be getting, whether we want them to or not. And I think the community has to be involved in this discussion.
Now, you were commenting about the police being able to review the videos. And so, could you tell us about what you were saying to the folks?
Well, that was one of the comments that I made last night, that there was an incident that happened recently where police officers shot and killed a man in a shopping mall parking lot. And the video from one of the nearby restaurants captured part of the incident. And before the officers got interviewed, they were allowed to watch back this footage. Now, in that case, it wasn't body camera footage. It was third-party footage. But it still seemed really outrageous in an incident where there's an officer-involved shooting, particularly, that they should be able to look at the footage and then maybe change their story based on what they see instead of writing their subjective memory of what happened. Somebody else in the audience mentioned that criminal suspects don't get to view surveillance footage or body camera footage before they testify, and the police quickly said, well, that's not always true. There are some cases where they do. It's like, well, that's great. There are some cases where they do, but then let's make things even so that if whatever kind of case where a civilian might be able to look at the footage is the only kind of case where a cop can look at it, and not every time. Because what we're afraid of is the police will change their story based on what they see in the video.
Indeed. Now, the Police Bureau, from what I've seen, wants to use money that's already been appropriated for in-car videos to pay for the body cams. Is this as the old robbing Peter to pay Paul? Do you think this is just a bad idea, or what do you think about that one?
Well, our organization decided to take a neutral stance on the body cameras. The police car cameras have an advantage in the fact that they are usually activated when the police turn on their overhead lights. Part of the discussion was last night is that we're going to be trusting the police to turn these cameras on and off when they have reasonable suspicion that a criminal activity has occurred. And I asked specifically if there should be punishment if they fail to do that, and the police said, yes, there will be, but it's going to be very hard, I think, to hold an officer accountable for that, except in some extreme cases where maybe they start interviewing somebody and they didn't remember to turn the camera on because they developed reasonable suspicion partway through their mere conversation with the person. I don't foresee this working very well with the officers having the ability to turn it on and off. Well, that said, you know, the cameras can only capture what's around the car or in the car. The body cameras are going to catch what the police do when they get out of the car and go onto the scene.
So now, switching gears for just a moment, the Community Oversight and Advisory Board has been losing a lot of members. People are basically seem to be calling it quits. What do you think? Can you give us your perspective on this, the COAB?
Well, the COAB was created as part of the Department of Justice settlement with the Bureau that came about because the police were found to be using excessive force, mostly particularly against people who are or perceived to have mental illness. And I think that the amount of work that's involved, I'm not on the board, and I probably spend 10 or 20 hours a month reading through documents, figuring out what their proposals are like, whether or not something that, you know, we at Portland Cop Watch, are we going to recommend that they pass this or not, and going to their meetings and all these other things. So the members who are actually part of the group, who have to read even more documentation to figure this all out, it's a lot of work. And I don't think anybody anticipated that when they created the board. So I think that's a lot of why people are dropping off. I think there are other issues going on that might be better discussed elsewhere, but there is an article in Street Roots about it that covers some of the issues. And I think there are certainly issues that have to do with the structure that could be fixed, that the city is not taking steps to fix, and that the DOJ is not taking steps to fix, and the compliance officer who was hired to facilitate the COAB is not taking steps to fix. I think that's the problem.
Some might even argue that the COAB was intended to be window dressing, not an actual solution, but something that would appear to be a thing that they're doing so that people would, well, stop complaining. Do you think that's unfair?
Well, when this process started, I would have told you that you were off base because this is the opportunity that is, and there's still some truth to what I'm about to say. This is an opportunity for the community to have input into the Federal Department of Justice coming in and trying to rearrange our local police force. And that has never really happened in the same way in any city that's happened here in Portland. However, even though the agreement describes the COAB as an independent body, the Department of Justice made it very clear that they are the final arbiters of everything, and so it doesn't really matter if the word independent is written in there, that the COAB is not going to be making any kind of final decision about whether or not the city's complying. So, to some extent, it is not on paper, but apparently the subtext of this agreement has always been that COAB is not going to have any kind of final say on anything.
I've been speaking with Dan Handelman. He's a member of Portland Cop Watch, portlandcopwatch.org. Dan, thank you so much.
Sure, thank you.
This is Doug McVeigh for KBOO News.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for investigative journalist and senior TED fellow Will Potter describing his experience as the first and only journalist to visit secretive prisons on U.S. soil that are referred to by prisoners and guards as Little Guantanamos. This will be followed by QTPOC Talk, a program on Portland's queer and trans communities of color, at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, areas of fog after 11 p.m., otherwise increasing clouds with a low around 48. Tomorrow, areas of fog before 11 a.m., otherwise mostly cloudy with a high near 64. Today in history, in 1947, the U.S. House Un-American Activities Committee opened meetings about alleged communist infiltration in the Hollywood film industry. And in 1973, President Nixon abolished the office of Special Watergate Prosecutor Archibald Cox, accepted the resignation of Attorney General Elliot L. Richardson, and fired Deputy Attorney General William B. Ruckelshaus in what became known as the Saturday Night Massacre. The quote of the day is from former Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, who said, "Nuclear weapons exist. They probably always will. And they work with horrible efficiency. They threaten the very future of our species. We have no choice but to manage that risk. Never again can we put the task out of our minds, nor trivialize it, nor make it routine, nor dare we lose heart."
It's 5:24. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
House Speaker John Boehner gave up his position because he couldn't stand the job anymore. Next in line was Representative Kevin McCarthy, who started running for the job but quickly backed off. Representative Paul Ryan says he's thinking about taking the job, even though he doesn't want it. What's at work here is the Crazy Caucus. At one level or another, nearly all Republican House members belong, but the caucus is driven by about 50 hyper-crazies who believe that the greatest problems facing our country are Hillary Clinton's emails, Planned Parenthood, the existence of public services, and the, quote, hordes of Mexicans who sneak into our country so they can vote for Democrats. It's the job of the House Speaker to try leading these mad dogs to an occasional bit of sanity. Who really wants to do that? Or even thinks it's possible? Well, several of the mad dogs themselves say they should be put in charge. Daniel Webster says he's available. Not the smart guy who compiled the dictionary, but a Tea Party bozo from Florida. Bill Flores, a little-known Tea Party know-nothing from Texas, says he would unite the House by getting all the members to, quote, spend enough time on our knees praying for each other. That's silly, but the idea of keeping lawmakers on their knees is appealing. Mike Pompeo of Kansas, a prince of right-wing pomposity who was elected by the billionaire Koch brothers to be their personal representative in Washington, says he's ready to lead the House toward a Koch-headed plutocracy. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's pathetic. But wait, we have another surprising choice. It's a little-known fact, but the Speaker of our House of Representatives does not actually have to be a member of Congress. So why don't we choose someone like a kindergarten teacher, a minimum wage worker, an organic farmer, or a circus ringmaster to run the show? Or maybe a group psychologist is what the place needs.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings. You are listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Beginning last week and continuing for a few more weeks, I am using my weekly commentary to unveil the fascinating story and chronology of how the U.S. Supreme Court over the past 196 years has transformed the business corporation from an institution that was legally subordinate to the people, beginning after the American Revolution, into something having more constitutionally protected so-called rights than do you or I. Shall we proceed? In 1803, the U.S. Supreme Court did a very gutsy thing. In the court case Marbury versus Madison, the Supreme Court decided that they were, in fact, supreme, no longer one of three equal pillars of government. The justices gave themselves the power to make law and to declare existing laws as unconstitutional, neither of which had ever been the intent of the nation's founders. This case established the concept of judicial review. Congress could have challenged the court's action, but chose not to. Then President Thomas Jefferson was so outraged by this seizure of governing authority by the highest court in the land that he stated, quote, "The Constitution on this hypothesis is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they please," unquote. Once the Supreme Court could overrule the other branches of government, any real notion of authentic representative democracy began to fray. Not to mention that in the early 1800s, only white-propertied men had the status of legal persons, so 99% of us could not even participate if we had wanted to. In 1819, in the case Dartmouth College v. Woodward, the Supreme Court overruled the New Hampshire Court, which had defended the New Hampshire legislature's authority to amend Dartmouth College's corporate charter, its defining document, to require it to admit all of the qualified young white men who wished to enroll, not just the white male children of elite families. This decision turned a corporate charter from a government-granted privilege into a contract that could not be unilaterally altered by government. In our work to dismantle corporate so-called rights, we say that this is the first case where the court found corporate rights in the U.S. Constitution, specifically in the Contracts Clause of the Constitution. This ruling gave the corporation a constitutional life for the very first time in U.S. history, 196 years ago. In other words, we are today just 4 years away from the 200th anniversary of corporations winning access to the Constitution of the United States, which in my opinion has been an absolute catastrophe for the rest of us. In the Dred Scott v. Sanford decision of 1857, the Supreme Court decided that slaves are property and Congress cannot deprive citizens of their property. Slaves are, quote, not citizens of any state and have no rights a court must respect, unquote. 11 years later, in 1868, the 14th Amendment was adopted. Black males were now U.S. citizens. Quote, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, unquote. Just 18 years later, the court would conclude that the word person also included corporations. In 1874, in the case Minor v. Happersat, the women's movement argued that under the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, the U.S. Constitution established that their right to vote could not be denied by the state. The Supreme Court rejected this argument, stating that the 14th Amendment was only intended to apply to black males. Here's some background on this 1874 women's rights court battle. Susan B. Anthony went to the polls and cast a vote in 1872, justifying her right to vote under the 14th Amendment. She was found guilty in a lower court, and it never went to the Supreme Court. In Bradwell v. Illinois, 1873, a married woman sued under the 14th Amendment to practice law. She was denied, and the opinion of Justice Bradley is a particularly strong explanation of how a woman's personhood comes from her husband. In Commonwealth v. Woloski, 1931, the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled that women cannot sit on juries and explained, quote, to the effect that the word person in construing statutes shall include corporations, it has also been held not to include women, unquote. Women were finally protected under the 14th Amendment in 1971 in Reed v. Reed. In other words, the business corporation was granted 14th Amendment personhood status 85 years before women won the same constitutional protections under law. Is this crazy or what? I've been sharing with you an unveiling of the fascinating chronology of how the U.S. Supreme Court, over the past 196 years, has transformed the business corporation from an institution that was legally subordinate to the people, beginning after the American Revolution, into something having more constitutionally protected so-called rights than do you or I. We'll continue with this timeline for another few weeks. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my twice-monthly updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
Canada has a new prime minister and a whole new government. Voters in Canada last night voted overwhelmingly for change. the Liberal Party swept into power, taking seats from both the Conservative Party and the New Democratic Party. The new Prime Minister will be Justin Trudeau, whose father, Pierre Trudeau, has been Prime Minister throughout the 1970s and into the early 1980s. The Liberal Party, which had only 37 seats in Parliament before the election, now has 184 seats, giving them a clear majority of 54% of Parliament. The Conservative Party, which took power in the 2011 elections, lost 67 seats, ending up with less than 30% of Parliament. Trudeau campaigned as a progressive on some social issues, calling for a national regulation plan for marijuana, higher taxes on the wealthy, and tax breaks for the middle class. He also called for a national public inquiry into the murders and disappearances of Indigenous women and girls. His stance on environmental issues, on the other hand, is mixed. Trudeau has indicated support for the Keystone XL pipeline, yet he also pledged to work with the provinces to reduce carbon pollution and combat climate change. Stephen Harper, the Conservative Prime Minister who Trudeau's party defeated, resigned last night. The new Prime Minister is expected to be sworn in by mid-November.
The Kalama River in Washington began to run milky white on Sunday, making it unfishable and alarming environmental groups in the state. But the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife has said there is no cause for alarm. The department said that they have seen similar milky conditions on the South Fork of the Toutle since mid-August. But the Kalama bubbles up from a spring, not the sides of Mount St. Helens, like the Toutle does. A spokesperson for the State Department of Ecology speculated that the milky color may be due to sediment stirred up by the river. The department said they have no reason to believe the color change was something caused by humans. Dave Knepper, a longtime resident and fisherman who lives near the river, thought the phenomenon might be caused by a possible mudslide farther up the river. Fish and wildlife officials said they would monitor the river and investigate the mystery further.
Homeowners in the Rotowin Basin in southern Colorado are discovering their water wells have been contaminated by a man-made chemical called tert-butyl alcohol, or TBA. The story came to light when one owner had his water tested in 2008, and TBA was found. TBA is found in many household items, but one place it should not be is underground and in well water. The east side of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains is dotted with fracking wells that have been intensely producing natural gas for the last 20 years. Tert-butyl hydrogen peroxide, typically used in fracking, breaks down into tert-butyl alcohol. However, the gas company denies using that chemical. The connection between TBA in the water and the fracking companies is difficult to prove, but one thing people know for sure is that before the drilling, the water was pure. Outside the area of drilling, the wells show no evidence of TBA. Until the situation is remedied, people are forced to obtain clean water from other sources. People are also finding out that properties are more difficult, if not impossible, to sell.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imamc.org for Tuesday, October 20th, 2015. Three Palestinian youth killed and more than 206 others injured by Israeli troops' gunfire during ongoing clashes in Gaza and the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Two Palestinians were shot dead by Israeli soldiers in southern West Bank on Tuesday, while a third Palestinian died after being shot by Israeli troops during clashes at border areas near central Gaza. Clashes between Palestinian youth and invading Israeli soldiers were reported all over the West Bank and Jerusalem. Since October 1st, 49 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,900 others injured by Israeli troops, according to Palestinian medical sources. An earlier report by the Ministry of Health showed that since the start of October, 5,500 residents were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation fired by Israeli troops targeting Palestinian protesters. On Tuesday afternoon, Hamza Musa Al-Amla, 25, was shot dead after his car ran into a soldier and a civilian. The incident happened at the Gush Etzion junction towards Jerusalem in the southern West Bank. Israeli media sources has reported that the car smashed into the two pedestrians before hitting a concrete barrier. It was alleged that he got out of the car with a knife in his hand before a soldier from Kfar Brigade opened fire, shooting him fatally in the head. Moreover, Israeli soldiers shot and killed on Tuesday before noon Uday Hussam Al-Masalma, 24, in Beit Awa town, southwest of the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Local sources said that soldiers shot Al-Masalma in the back of his head from a very close distance and that the bullet exited through his face. Soldiers also fired several live rounds at the Palestinian, especially his legs. In the Gaza Strip, Israeli forces shot and killed a Palestinian and injured nine others with live fire on Tuesday during clashes on the border of the northern and central Gaza Strip. Ahmed Al-Sarahi, 27, was shot dead east of Al-Burej refugee camp. Six others were injured with live rounds. In northern Gaza, eight Palestinians were injured near the Erez crossing. Three Palestinians were shot and injured with live fire, and five others suffered injuries from tear gas, at least one of which was hit with a tear gas canister. Moreover, 206 Palestinians have been injured on Tuesday during ongoing clashes between local youth and invading Israeli soldiers in West Bank communities, Palestinian sources reported. Clashes were reported in the central West Bank city of Ramallah, Nablus and Qalqilya in the north, in addition to the southern West Bank cities of Bethlehem and Hebron. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society said that 16 youth were injured by Israeli troops' live gunfire, 28 with rubber-coated steel bullets, and 165 were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, October 20th, 2015 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Cliff Verla and Chris Andre. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on this news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland at KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Jared Dantzler.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Roland's guest is Jacqueline Keeler, a writer and activist of Diné and Yankton Dakota heritage, who has written on the racist appropriation of Native culture and has helped reignite a national debate on cultural appropriation. At 9, on Political Perspectives, host Linda Olson Osterlund interviews ACLU attorney Stephen Watt about their lawsuit against U.S. psychologists who designed and ran the CIA's torture operation. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's the KBOO Food Show with Chris Siegel and Rachel Bennett. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thank you, members, for your support. To become a member, just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for an in-depth report with investigative journalist and senior TED fellow with Will Potter, describing his experience as the first and only journalist to visit secretive prisons on U.S. soil that are referred to by prisoners and guards as Little Guantanamos. Good night, Nicole.
Good night, Jared.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Father Daniel Berrigan once said that writing about prisoners is a little like writing about the dead. I think what he meant is that we treat prisoners as ghosts. They're unseen and unheard. It's easy to simply ignore them, and it's even easier when the government goes to great lengths to keep them hidden. As a journalist, I think these stories of what people in power do when no one is watching are precisely the stories that we need to tell. That's why I began investigating the most secretive and experimental prison units in the United States for so-called second-tier terrorists. The government calls these units Communications Management Units, or CMUs. Prisoners and guards call them Little Guantanamo. They are island